Hey everybody, how you doing? Dave Smith here, just dropping in for a minute to let you know about these two talks that you're about to hear. I have a new program that meets on Wednesday nights from 6 to 7:15 p.m. Mountain Standard Time. It's a Dharma Live Online. These are the first two talks talking about the backdrop of the historic Buddha, the difference between Buddhism and the Dharma, and a little bit about the world and the culture in which the Buddha grew up in. And if you want to join us, if you want to be have access to these talks and to be in the live sessions, you can click here and subscribe. Anyway, I hope you're all doing good out there. Hope to see you live in living color someday soon. Be safe, y'all. So everybody can hear me and see me okay? The audio and the video is acceptable. Thumbs up. Cool. Thank you, everybody. Very happy to be here with you at the beginning of this new incarnation. Although I spend lots of time in this chair, in this room, talking to this screen about these ideas. So happy to be with you. And thank you very much for joining and being with me in this practice. So I'm just going to say just a couple logistic things. And also, I'm recording the audio. So most of you saw it through Rizuku. You should get familiar with this Rizuku thing that I house everything in, which is what you registered through. If you go to the website, if you go to the link, it's where I'm going to put the talks. There's some suggested reading in there. It's kind of like a mini little class, but you can get it on your phone. You can get it on your tablet. You can get it on your desktop. It's really quite handy. They don't have an app, so you don't download the Rizuku app. You have to go to the browser address, but you'll get used to it. It's really, really good. I think you'll like it. And that's what I'll do is I record the audio for the talks and the meditations. I do not record the questions and answers because I think it's a privacy thing and maybe people don't want to be on the recording. And I think that when I do record the questions and answers, people don't ask good questions. So that part's not on there. But I will also break them up. So there'll be a section that'll say Dharma Talks and then Guided Meditation. So as we go through the months and the years and however long this goes on for, if you miss one of the sessions, you can go listen to it again. Or if you liked one of the sessions, you can listen to it as much as you like. And I do record pretty good audio, so the audio is really good. I'm a kind of a stickler for good audio. So that will be available to you. If you have any questions, you can email me. I don't have a big admin department, so I encourage you and kind of expect you to find your way around Rizuku. It's really quite easy. And you can also even email support@rizuku.com, and the good folks there will actually help you. We still do, some places in this country still do have customer service, so that's a good thing. So what we'll do basically every week is sort of the same thing. There'll be a 30-minute or so guided meditation, 30-minute or so Dharma talk, and then 15 minutes for really questions and answers about the talk or about the meditation. Sometimes I'll do the meditation first, sometimes I'll do the Dharma talk first. It just depends on a number of things that really aren't that interesting. So that's it. And it's an open-ended class. You can sign up. You can leave anytime. If you know anybody else who might be interested in taking the course, you can. Anybody can come in. I think the Zoom can handle as many people as we want. If you haven't used Zoom before, as I suspect most of you have, if you open up the bottom of your screen, there's a little thing that says Reactions. And if you click on that, you can raise your hand. So if you have a question, it's better to raise your hand, because if you raise your hand like this, I might not see it, and then you'll feel like I'm ignoring you, and then we'll all feel bad. So if you can do that, that's cool. Or if you don't want to ask the question, you can go in the bottom there to the thing that says chat. You can type a question in. Also, when you go to the Dharma Talks section in Rizuku, where the audio will be restored, where audio will be uploaded, you'll see at the bottom there's a little bit of a prompt. A chance where you can actually talk about the talks. If you want to have an interaction conversation with each other, there'll be places you can do that. Some of you will like that. Some of you won't like that so much. But I try to over-deliver. I know that, you know, there's a lot of stuff out there, and I want to make sure that the stuff that you're using with me is easy to use and accessible and ideally, hopefully, helpful. So that's enough about that. That's also recorded there so people can listen to that again later. Usually sometimes I forget to record this part and then I kick myself in the ass later. You know, I just gave them all the instructions and I didn't record it. So, all right. So I'm sure many of you know me. I know many of you. My name's Dave Smith. I'm a Buddhist meditation teacher, Dharma teacher, and I've been teaching for a long time, maybe 12 years or so. And so I just want to talk a little bit about what the group is going to focus on. I know that there's lots of meditation groups out there. There's lots of meditation communities. There's lots of stuff out there, and I appreciate you taking the time to sit with me. I think it's really important that I kind of explain where I'm coming from. And really, the first place I would say where I'm coming from is I'm not really a Buddhist, actually. I'm not really interested in Buddhism. And I could go on and on about that, and I might, but probably not right at the moment. And so why do I say that? Because I've been practicing Buddhist meditation, or what I prefer to call Dharma, for almost 30 years now. And it's been a really big struggle for me trying to come to terms with some of this stuff. If you, God forbid, you go to Barnes & Noble, back when we used to go to Barnes & Nobles and look under the Buddhism section, it's a huge, huge thing. And it can be really kind of a nightmare to try to find your way around and try to figure all this stuff out, all the meditations, all the different theories, all the philosophies, all the psychology, all the esoteric ideas. But really where I'm coming from is what we would call an early Buddhist perspective. Many of you probably know the lay of the land is kind of Theravada Buddhism, which is mostly what I'm trained in, insight meditation. Jack Kornfield, Joseph Goldstein, Noah Levine, Sharon Salzberg, the whole insight world in our culture. It's kind of the training that I'm from. But I'm even going back farther than that now, to what's known as early Buddhism, which is really what are found in the pages of the Pali Canon. So when we look to the Buddhist tradition, if you go all the way back, everything really comes from this 5,000-page document that, frankly, kind of a nightmare to read, that are really the historic teachings of the Buddha. And so I mostly am obsessed with this stuff. I've been studying it for a long time. I actually know a lot of the original language, a lot of the Pali language. And so most of the stuff that I'm going to talk about will come from that perspective. And there's actually quite a lot there. It's not a light topic of material. And I'm not saying that because I think that's the better stuff, or I'm not trying to say it's the right stuff. I'm just saying that that's where I'm coming from. And I have found that as I've been looking at this stuff for a long time, a lot of the stuff that confused me about Buddhism, things like enlightenment, things like the ending of suffering, things like not self, some of these seemingly esoteric ideas, which can be quite confusing, when we go back and look at the historical texts where the Buddha's coming from, none of it's really very confusing, actually. So my hope is to maybe confuse some of you and maybe unconfuse some of you as we kind of get into this material, because I think what's there is really profound. And I'll talk more about that this evening. That's kind of what I'm going to talk about a little bit. Also, most of the meditations that we will practice together will come also from that kind of thinking. Early Buddhist tradition, things like mindfulness practices. There's many mindfulness practices. Heart practices, also known as Brahma-Vihara practices. Cultivation of the heart, of kindness and compassion and gratitude and equanimity, and mixing those. But the school of thinking that I most pull from when it comes to cultivating the mind, developing the mind through meditation, is when we look at all the various schools of Buddhist meditation, whether it's a Thai forest or Zen or various schools of Tibetan thinking. There's lots of different kinds of Buddhist meditations. In fact, there's so many, it can be really confusing if you've tried some of them. Some of them are very odd. In that, my primary teacher is a teacher named Stephen Smith, who was one of the last Westerners who was ordained by Mahasi Sayadaw, who was a Burmese meditation master. In my opinion, my belief, my experience has been, when it comes to actually understanding the mind as a process, as an event, as a kind of contraption, if you will, that we're kind of born with, this equipment of the mind, the Sayadaws of Burma really have the most systematic, verifiable tracking experience for how the mind operates. So a lot of the techniques and a lot of the meditation practices will come from that line of thinking, because they've systematized the mind in exhaustive detail. So a lot of the meditations we do will come from that kind of thinking. And then the last thing I'll say is this. you might be asking yourself this question right now, perhaps, is, and people ask me this all the time, when they get new to the practice, like, how important is it that we actually know the backstory of all this stuff? You know, shouldn't I just practice mindfulness and try to be more kind and more generous? And, you know, how important is it that we know the backdrop of where this stuff came from? And for me, it's been actually very important. It's been very, very helpful to uncover the really original message and the really basic ideas, the core ideas that were developed by the Buddha 2,600 years ago. I don't even like calling him the Buddha, really. Siddhartha Gautama was his name. That understanding the roots and the basic ideas where this stuff came from actually weeds out a lot of the esoteric, confusing stuff that came later. So I think there's a lot of value in understanding where this stuff comes from, and not just trusting the folktale stories you've heard or the PBS special you might have saw on the Buddha. A lot of the stories that we hear and a lot of the stuff that we learn about in Buddhism is not historically accurate, actually. A lot of it's kind of folklore, which is fine, but I err on the side typically more of, I actually really honestly want to know what happened. You know, I really am kind of become obsessed to some degree with what was the context of the life in the world that this man actually lived in. So I'm going to talk a little bit more about that tonight. But I do want to begin, I think, this time, because we're just getting started with a seated practice. Probably here for maybe about 20 minutes this evening to begin, and I'll say a few words about that. So one of my first teachers, Joseph Goldstein, used to tell this story that I like, that's very relevant, I think, for this part of the course as we're just getting started. As he was in India in the late 60s, really wanting to know something, wanting to know about Buddhism, wanting to know the Dharma, wanting to know, I need to know. And he used to chase this little Bengali guy around named Munindra. Munindra was a Bengali guy who was also a very learned scholar. He was a Mahasi Sayadaw student, and he was kind of a master of this Dharma. And I think Munindra used to get tired of Joseph pestering all the time, and he stopped Joseph Goldstein one day and said, listen, he said, if you really want to understand your mind, if you really want to understand what's going on here, sit down and observe it. If you sit down and observe your mind, you will know everything that you need to know, which is actually quite little. What you need to know is not that much. What you need to know how to do is a lot. It's a lot. So in the spirit of that, I think we have to understand that half of meditation, mindfulness practice, Dharma practice really, is about technique. Right, we have to have some kind of technique, some kind of technology, meditation technology, in which there is some, being able to keep our attention on the breath, being able to overcome distraction, being able to, you know, have some basic techniques so that way we can even get into this experience. The other half of it is kind of, I would say, experiential. I might even go so far as to say it's poetic. It's mysterious. It's a lot of it is stuff that really can't be described. But there are things that you can come to know for yourself, that you can come to realize for yourself. So that's kind of the hope and the trust of practice, is that as you do this, you will learn some things about your mind. You will learn some things about how your mind operates and where your influence lies. That will help you. And will help you navigate the world with more clarity, with more kindness, and really allow you to ultimately become the person that you wish to become. I think that's the whole point of all this. It's not so we can have some peaceful, mystical state or some, you know, we're not trying to get anywhere. There's no there, which is, I know, frustrating when you start learning this stuff, because we want to have some kind of fucking magic experience that is going to have some impact on everything. And it just, you know, I can tell you in 30 years, I ain't had it. So either it doesn't exist or I'm horrible at this shit. And I've definitely clocked some hours. So when we practice in this way, there's really kind of what we're paying attention to and the attitude we have. So a lot of it is not A lot of the meditation experience, frankly, is the attitude that you bring to it. You know, am I wanting something to happen? Am I waiting for something to happen? Am I waiting for something to go away? And we miss out on the experience. So I'll do a very basic practice, which I think is kind of the foundation of everything that I teach, which is technically called metta vipassana, which is another way to say that is kind awareness. It's the mixture of kindness and friendliness with mindfulness. And really what it means is to be present, but also to be at ease, to be here, but to also be okay. And you need to be able to develop both those qualities. You need to have some degree of presence, but you also need to have some degree of it's okay, a degree of safety, a degree of ease, a degree of acknowledging whatever is also here. So it's mindfulness. The moment is full, chock full. And so how are we in that fullness? And a lot of times, yeah, we're not so good. Not such a great attitude. We don't like this. We don't like that. We want this to go. We want that to go. We want the body to not hurt. We want the mind to shut up. With all kinds of fucking agenda we come with to the practice. So we'll do this light practice now. And then I'll talk some more about this. So as you can tell, I'm fairly excited about the beginning of this group. So I'm probably talking more than I need to. So I'll talk a little bit more for a little while, then we'll have some questions and answers about this, where I'm coming from business. And so probably get this out of the way. I won't probably use the word Buddhism that much moving forward, and I much more prefer the term Dharma. And I'll just kind of unpack that a little bit. I actually don't. You know, if I had to fill out a form and they asked me my religion, I would probably have to check off Buddhism, but I would do so very reluctantly. In fact, living where I live in rural Colorado and navigating the world the way that I do, sometimes I when I go to a social event or I go somewhere, I kind of hope nobody asks me what I do because I don't want to have to deal with this question so much. I usually just tell people I work in mental health, and that usually shuts down the conversation pretty quick. But once in a while, my pesky wife will elbow me in the side, go, he doesn't work in mental health, he teaches Buddhism, and then the can of worms opens. And the word Dharma, actually, to be honest with you, that I have almost, I would even go so bold to say, I feel like I almost have a religious relationship to that word and to that concept. So I'll just kind of say that there's a difference between the two, and I think it's worth unpacking here before we get into this stuff, as we will over the next weeks, months, and perhaps even years. So without a doubt, there's no really way around it. Buddhism is a world's religion. It's been a world's religion for 2,500 years. It has many, many different schools, many, many different philosophies. It's a huge part of Asian society, and it is definitely here to stay. And I also want to say that I'm not, in no way am I at all anti-Buddhism. I think Buddhism is great. But Buddhism is a product of a 2,500-year-old, mostly Asian monastic tradition. So Buddhism has grown over the centuries through monastic training, largely of a male stature, people living in monasteries, studying texts, doing these practices, basically not dealing with the world, not dealing with money, not dealing with sexuality, not dealing with civic responsibility, not really having to deal with any of the stuff that we have to deal with so that they can do these practices, which is fine. I think that's great. I hope that that continues. But what happens is in the process of that is people like us and a lot of people in the last 50, 60, 70 years in our culture who live in busy American lives with children and stress and sexuality and sexual relationships and bills and car payments and rent and all the stuff that y'all deal with, it can be hard to go, well, how does this actually fit for me? You know, I don't have 18 hours a day to sit in the monastery. I'm lucky to sit for 20 minutes a day and maybe go on one retreat a year. And that just doesn't feel like enough. And so we can kind of feel this. And I know I felt this for years of sort of less than. I'm not really a good Buddhist. I'm actually not even, a lot of times I even felt like I was a little bit of an imposter of like, you know, I don't have the time or the energy to do this. And I lived much of my adult life with a fairly amount of freedom and didn't have children for a long period of time and was able to do a lot more practicing and never felt like it was enough. So how do we if we choose to do this, how do we live a Dharma-informed life? And so the word Dharma is Buddhism took the Dharma and created Buddhism. But if we go way, way, way back, well, what is this Dharma thing and how is it different than Buddhism? And as much as we can deconstruct Buddhism, we can talk about different traditions and different theories and different philosophies and different schools. You can't really do that with the Dharma, actually. Interestingly enough, the Dharma is almost an impossible word to translate. Mostly what the Dharma means is what the Buddha taught. So their teachings. Sometimes it means something like law, order, the way of things. Really, maybe, probably in most colloquial terms, it would call it's a map for how to live. And if we go back, actually, which is which is what I do and what we will do, if we go back to 5th century BC India, and we look at what was going on in the world then, in the time in the world that the Siddhartha Gautama taught, there was actually not just a few, hundreds, maybe thousands of people who were practicing the Dharma, who were farmers, who were arrow makers, who were hunters, who were bankers, who were people who lived in the world. They made pottery, people who were living in the world and having families and living lives. They were also practicing the Dharma. And this is very well recorded and documented. The problem is, because they never had a monastic tradition to carry forth, we don't actually entirely know what those folks were doing. So what was it like if you had family and you had financial responsibility and you had a household to run and you had civic responsibilities and you had other family responsibilities? If you had all of that and you were practicing the Dharma, what would it be that you were doing? And so many academics agree, and this is kind of coming out now, and I certainly agree, and is that there actually was this other Dharma path that people were doing. But we don't have any documented sense of what that might have been. So there's this kind of movement in the Dharma world, a very small movement, of people who say, like, well, let's take a look at that. Let's uncover that. So let's just politely, and I say politely in all sincerity, let's politely just put aside all the monastic rules and all the stuff that was dedicated to the monastery, just aside. If we put that aside and look back at the Dharma, what would we find? You know, and what would we find? And would it be relevant to the lives we live now? And would it be enough for us to feel comfortable and to feel confident and actually to feel optimistic that we can do this also, that we can have a life that we live a life that's an awakened life, a life where we're awake, where we know we have some fucking clue of what might be going on here. We have some clue about the ways in which we're limited, in which there are many. We're limited by the demands of the body. We're limited by the demands of the culture. We're limited by lots of demands of the world. And we need to be realistic about what those are. But we also want to be aware of, and we actually want to be optimistic about the possibilities of what is it possible for us in this life, in the conditions that you have, in the family that you grew up in, the neighborhood that you grew up in the world that you grew up in, the trauma that you grew up in, whatever it was for you, the addiction, the recovery, all of that. And we're kind of burdened with this task, I think, of trying to make sense of all of this. Not so that we can understand it and like stick it in a box on the shelf and go, I know why my life is hard. Not for that, but for the sense of how can we use that to become the fertile ground for what it is that we want to do next. And the other thing that's interesting about early Buddhism is when you go back and look at the early Buddhist ideas, they're very, very similar, actually scarily similar, to a lot of the ideas that we see in modern neuroscience. That the mind is not this like janky contraption that you're stuck with. The mind is neuroplastic. You can actually teach an old dog new tricks. That anything that you perceive as a psychological challenge or an emotional challenge in your inner life can certainly be understood and can certainly be overcome, all of it, no doubt. I mean, that's like not even up for debate anymore. So that's exciting. That's encouraging. And so when we think about, you know, if we sat the Buddha down, and people did actually, there's a story I was reading the other day in the canon where the Buddha is, he's actually about to die. As maybe you know this, he died outside of Varanasi at the age of 85, it's told, between two sal trees that he laid down underneath after what they believe consuming some poisonous or rancid or just, you know, some meat, actually some pork that he had eaten. And somebody comes up to him and, you know, wants to take refuge and wants to, you know, I've been chasing him down. I finally caught the guy. Now he's dying. I want to do this Dharma thing that I've been hearing about. You know, what? How do I do that? And the Buddha said to him, he goes, well, you know, after I die and as things go on, anywhere you find the Eightfold Path, then you can trust that you're going to find my teachings. So he's always pointing people to this. Wherever you find this Eightfold Path is where you can trust that you're going to find an authentic representation of what it is that I'm asking you to do, which is eight things, right? So people get confused about this. You know, they look at the Four Noble Truths, which is a word I probably won't repeat again because I don't think there's anything noble or truthful about these noble truths. Is that, you know, we get bogged down in this, okay, Buddhism's about getting rid of suffering once and for all. Well, no, that's not going to happen. Buddhism's about reaching this enlightened state of nirvana where, you know, we're going to reach this epic state. And once we reach this epic state, everything's going to be easy. There'll be no more problems. No, that's not it either. So you can put those two aside. But what we're being asked to do is to cultivate this path, this eightfold path, these eight branches, these eight things. And mostly in our culture, in the last many years, meditation's kind of gotten to be the kind of top dog, right? Like mindfulness, you know, you go to the Whole Foods or you go to your little local health food store and in the rack, you see the pretty white lady meditating on the beach, mindfulness magazine. Just be mindful and everything's going to be easy for you, right? Yeah, like that's fucking going to work out, right? But that's what we get. And so the term that they use, and I'll repeat this, I'll mention this many times as we move ahead. Sorry, I've been sick. Actually, there's no term in the early Buddhist lexicon that means anything like the word meditate. So I know it's ironic. As a meditation teacher, I don't like the word meditation. And as a Buddhist teacher, I don't like the word Buddhism. Actually, the only ism that's ever worked for me is alcoholism, but that's a whole nother story. That's the only ism that really makes any sense to me. But the word for meditation that we see is this word bhavana, which literally means to cultivate. So the Buddha's trying to get us to cultivate something. And what he's really trying to get us to cultivate is ourselves, our life. And cultivate means that we try to take something or we try to find something that's not here and we want to bring it into being. That's what cultivation means. It means to bring something into existence, to bring something into being that's not already here, right? Like, you know, like if you have a garden and you want to grow flowers or you want to grow tomatoes or you want to grow cucumbers, you don't just get a little package of seeds and chuck them on the ground and hope for the best. You actually have to cultivate. You have to, you actually have to work at this. So largely what I think, when we say practice, what when we say our practice, I'll use the word a lot. You'll hear me use the word Dharma practice. I don't mean just sitting on a cushion and watching your breath. That's mostly what it's been reduced to, my practice. I'm going to go practice now. I'm going to go sit in the corner and sit on a little uncomfortable cushion and cross my legs and try to follow my breathing without getting too upset with myself, right? That's kind of what it is, right? But that's one of eight. So I'm trying to cultivate this whole person, this whole person that I'm not yet, maybe, right? And do I ever finish? Do I ever stop and go, okay, I'm fully cultivated now. I'm fully happy with the version of Dave Smith that I've cultivated. Honestly, not happy with this version. I have previous versions which were much worse than this one, I can assure you that. But I'm not done. And I don't think there's such a thing as being done. In fact, sometimes being done or thinking that you're done is actually the worst thing of all, because then we just get stuck. You know, and we get stuck and we get caught up in things like doubt, and we get caught up in things like, well, this is just how I am. You know, I've been doing this shit for years. This is how I am. I'm always like this. I'm always going to be like that. You know, I can't handle my emotions. I'm never going to be able to handle my emotions. I've never been able to handle my emotions. And it's just not going to happen. So we kind of throw our hands up and we stay stuck, or we plateau, or we settle. I think this is one of the things that people do that I think is very tragic, is we just settle. We settle for the relationship because, it's good enough. I don't want to rock the boat. We settle for the job because, it's good enough. I don't want to, you know, we settle for a lot of things. In our culture, in our society, in the world right now, we kind of get a little bit rewarded for that. You know, everybody, the world wants us to settle, you know. Which sometimes can look like acceptance, which is, I don't like the word acceptance so much, actually. I think sometimes we find ourselves accepting things that we have no business accepting. And we kind of settle. I know, you ever do that, the feeling where you just sort of give up? You're like, I'm never going to fucking lose any weight. I'm just going to have some more golden grams or some honeycombs. Or I'm never going to really do that thing that I've always wanted to do. It's that voice of doubt in the mind that the Buddha speaks about of so often in the teachings. It's that voice in the mind that tells you, you can't do that. You're not going to learn that language. You're not going to get that new job. You're not going to get out of this fucking destructive relationship. You're not going to meet somebody new. You're not going to do that. Right? That kind of destructive whisper in the back of the mind that tells you can't, or you won't, or if you haven't yet, you're not going to do it now. Right? And we settle. And so in that moment, what actually happens is we are no longer cultivating. The cultivation process is over. You know, the bag of seeds and the shovel and the bucket of water go back in the shed. And we just go back inside and have a spot on the couch. You know, have some sugar and some fucking TV and call it a day, right? Which, of course, there's a place for that. But we really have to watch out for this kind of thinking. And so when we look at this practice of the Dharma, I think it's not even practice as much as it's work. Is that it's all just work, you know? It's not about, you know, sitting quietly and having this internal bliss. There might be some of that. It's how much work are we willing to do? And one of my teachers says this, which obviously used to really freak me out, but now I believe him. But years ago, I was sitting at the Insight Meditation Society with a guy named Steve Armstrong, who I highly recommend you check him out. He's on Dharma Seed. He's a brilliant teacher. Not very popular. Most of the good teachers are the people you never hear about. And he used to say about effort, because this is all work, which work means effort. It means willingness. It means resolve. It means trying. It means enthusiasm. It means courage. He says, whether you are totally miserable or in suffering in your life and totally convinced it's all going down in shit, or whether you're totally thriving and totally having a meaningful life and kicking ass, it's the same amount of effort. Either way, right? Whether you're struggling or whether you're thriving, the effort's the same. The question becomes, is, am I understanding the game? Am I understanding the challenge? Am I understanding what it is that I might have actually foolishly signed up for here? And I like that. I like that. I play that game once in a while every day. You know, and it really puts me back in touch with, you know, on the cultivation tip, is actually moment to moment to moment, every moment of my life, I'm cultivating something. I'm cultivating worry. I'm cultivating fear. I'm cultivating skepticism. I'm cultivating cynicism. Or I'm cultivating optimism. I'm cultivating flexibility. I'm cultivating openness. I'm cultivating kindness. The mind is, you probably all know this, it's always up to something, isn't it? Never once in my entire life, in all the years of meditation, have I ever reached a moment where my mind just goes, sorry, Dave, I got nothing for you. I'm out. Fresh out. I got nothing. Never. It's always got something. It's always got some witty, unhelpful comment to make about how I'm not doing it right, or how I'm not trying enough, or how it's those people's fault, or that person's fault. So it's always up to something. And the last thing I'll say is, one of the analogies the Buddha makes is with cultivation is that he says, a tree that leans to the west will fall to the west. So as a tree grows, as it leans, whatever direction it leans in, that's where it's going to fall, and that's the trail, that's the path that it's going to make. A tree that leans to the east will fall to the east. So the question we have to ask ourselves is, which way is your mind leaning? Are you leaning into doubt, into uncertainty, into blaming, into victimhood? Or are you leaning into openness and possibilities and understanding? Right? Although most of our trees probably getting blown all over the place all the time. But I think when you play the Dharma and you play the long game, you just have to be leaning 1 degree in the right direction. 51-49 is good enough. We don't need 90-10. We don't need 99-1. We need 51-49, and we're good. So we also have to be careful that we don't put too much pressure and too much on ourselves because of the fact that this is such hard work, and that probably like me, the majority of your time in your day is dealing with surviving, which is part of the path, is dealing with work, which is part of the path, which is dealing with having to fucking talk to the other humans all the time. You know, having to have conversations with the other humans that you don't even want to ever talk to again. And that's part of the practice, right? So if we take this on, if everything's part of the practice and everything's work, then we might be able to be a little bit more relaxed in knowing that we're trying to play a game that's a lot. All right. Welcome to Dharma Live Online. Dave Smith here with you. Thanks for joining and signing up and being with me in this practice. Second week here, so kind of digging in a little bit. I'm not going to repeat much of what I said last week. If you want to listen to what I said last week, it's in the Rizuku thing. The audio's in there. Because I kind of did a big setup for where I'm coming from, what I'm teaching. And instead of having to do that every week, I'm just going to dig in. And so just briefly last week, I spoke a little bit about the difference between Buddhism and the Dharma. And so this is really the study of the Dharma is much more interesting, I think, actually, and helpful to me than the study of Buddhism, even though I've done both. So part of what I talked about, and I'll talk a little bit about tonight, and you'll have to forgive me if these details are not that interesting to you, but I find having a sense of the backdrop of where this stuff comes from, I have found it to be very helpful to me because most of my life, generally speaking, I've always been suspicious of things like religion, even like spirituality, but a lot of these kind of mystical ideas that somewhat revolve around God or some other world out there that we don't have access to and might never have access to. I've always been pretty suspicious of those ideas. And what made it hard for me is somebody who was introduced to the Dharma when I was very young, when I was 18, I didn't have any sense of, I didn't know anything about Buddhism. I didn't even know what the hell the Dharma was. I thought the Buddha was like the guy at the Chinese restaurant. I had no idea. And but I found the practice of mindfulness to be very helpful, like immediately. Like really immediately. I was like, oh my God, this is like really useful shit. So I was convinced from my own experience that this was valuable. And then the more that I stuck around, the more that I practiced, I started to hear these stories about this guy named the Buddha and his teachings and where he came from. And a lot of it starts to get kind of folklorish and it gets very Santa Claus very quickly for me, which actually makes me frankly, trust it less. So in the last, let me take this out of my mouth. In the last, I don't know, 10 or 15 years, I've been a little bit obsessed with trying to uncover the historic Buddha. So really, this person who lived in 5th century BCE India, Siddhartha Gautama was his name. I actually prefer to call him Gautama than the Buddha at this point. But there's a lot of... So I just want to talk about the historical context of who he was and where he came from, because I actually think it's helpful in understanding the secular world that he lived in. Because most of the stories you've heard about the Buddha growing up in this palace and his family being this rich family who are isolating him from the world, none of that actually turns out to be true. So if we go back to 5th century BC India, somewhere around 580 BCE, What was going on in the world at that time? There was other things going on in the world at the time that are interesting, I think, to point out. First of all, if you go 3,600 miles to the east, you end up in Athens, Greece. And the Buddha and Socrates were alive at around about the same time, which most people don't know or don't actually recognize. So the Greek Empire, Greek philosophy, all of the stuff that most of us were educated in going into schools was happening around the same time as the Buddhist teachings, 3,600 miles away. If you went 700 miles to the northeast, you would have come into what's now modern-day Pakistan, Punjab, Pakistan, which would have been at the time a city of Taxila. I don't know how many of you have studied world religions, but the city of Taxila was kind of the Mecca of the day. It was really at the height of the Persian Empire. In the North Road, where the Buddha lives, up if you traveled the North Road out of India, out of northern India, across in northeast into Pakistan, you would have come to Taxila. So it's likely to understand that people might have had, there might have been some discourse and some cross-pollination there. So he grew up in a very historical, important time. And he didn't grow up in a palace, because we know from archaeology and things like that, there were no palaces in ancient India. There were no palaces in ancient India. There were no bricks. There was no glass. There was no metal. Anything that a quote-unquote palace would have been built of, those things weren't even available at the time. So he definitely didn't grow up in a palace. And the story, if you've seen the, you know, the PBS documentary on the Buddha, most of the documentaries or any of the stories you've heard about the Buddha are nice stories, but they're historically totally inaccurate. There's no way any of that stuff happened. Which I actually, when I found that out, I was actually a little bit disappointed and a little bit relieved, because now we're starting to understand that this was actually a real person. Really no different than any of us. No different than any of us, really, at all. And so he grew up in an agrarian society. So he grew up in basically a farming culture. And at the time, you know, the river basin of the Ganges was a very fertile place. So there was lots of crops, lots of farming, lots of agriculture. And at the time he was growing up, there was so much agriculture and so much farming and so much abundance. It was actually the beginning of things like money, and the beginning of things like cities, and the beginning of things where people weren't just farmers anymore. They were merchants. And it was kind of the beginning of a society, if you will. So a very important time, very interesting. Actually, even if you're not interested in Buddhism, if you look at world history, if you're one of those like world history professors, you would be very interested in this time in northern India, because it was a time of actually great change. So people were moving from tribal communities to things like cities, which is why the monks could go around and they could beg. They could go out with their bowls, and there was enough of food around that people would give them food. People had, you know, there was people making rope. There was people doing pottery. There was a lot of different stuff starting to happen at the time of him kind of growing up. His family was a tribe. So they were really more like tribal communities at this time, more so than anything else. Was a tribal, he's from the area of Kosala. And his tribe was called the Sakyans. And which actually means sun worshippers. So they were basically people who believed that they were you know, people think the Buddha grew up in a Hindu society and a Brahmin society, and he grew up in this religious context. None of that actually stands up at all. That's not true. He was really more tribal, and they believed that they were born, that they were people of the sun. They were sun worshippers, Sakyans. And so he probably was, you know, his family were probably pretty wealthy. They were probably like really successful, wealthy farmers. They also would have owned slaves. Slaves, they had slavery back then. The Buddha's family, would he would have been a slave owner who were working the fields. He probably lived in a really nice mud wood structure. Not a palace. Probably pretty nice for a wooden mud house, but that's about it. And so the world that he grew up in, there's a great book some of you might have read many years ago written called What the Buddha Taught by Rahula Wapola. If you've never seen it, I highly recommend it. It's maybe a book from the early 80s by sort of an academic book, and a guy who was a monk named Rahula Wapola wrote a book called What the Buddha Taught. And then a couple years later, one of his students, Richard Gombrich, who's a kind of world-renowned Buddhist scholar at Oxford University, he wrote a book. Rahula Wapola was one of his teachers. He wrote a book called What the Buddha Thought, which is kind of an interesting book. What did the Buddha think? And I thought that, always thought that was an interesting title and an interesting idea. What, you know, if this person grew up in this world and developed this Dharma practice, which obviously must have had some weight to it because it's still around now. So obviously, without a doubt, the Buddha, historical Buddha, one of the world's greatest thinkers in the history of the world. Otherwise, his ideas wouldn't have lasted all the way up until now. But what were some of the things that would have given him his ideas? And so if you think about the sun, which is an interesting thing to think about in terms of what were some ideas that would have conditioned him, how would he have understood how the world worked? And one of the things that he would have understood, because he grew up in an agrarian farming culture, is he would have been very aware of the concept of seed and fruit, right? So you have a seed, you stick it in the ground, you take care of it, you water it, you know, you cultivate it. And if you do that properly, that seed will bear fruit. So he would have been very aware of this idea. And so it's interesting that this word cultivate is actually a farming, more of a farming terminology. And I think he spoke about this last week, but when the Buddha started teaching, everything that he taught, meditation, the word meditation that we have now, which is actually a terrible term really, comes from this word bhavana, which means to cultivate. So what the Buddha is very interested in is how do we cultivate ourselves? How do we cultivate a life? And cultivate means you take something that's not here and you bring it into being. You know, like if I take a peach pit seed, you know, I look at the peach pit seed and think to myself, someday if I was willing to do the hard work, this peach could actually become a delicious peach that I could eat. But if I just take that concept and that peach and chuck it on the shelf behind me, even though I know that the seed has the potential, nothing's going to happen, right? That's pretty obvious. So he would have been really, really aware of these ideas. So if you think about the sun again, there's really two things that the sun represents. And the first and obvious one is light. So the sun is how we can see. It's what provides light, what provides nourishment for the planet. And also we could think of the sun as wisdom, the aspect of the mind that can see what's going on, the knowing of the mind, the idea of you walk into a dark room and you turn a light on, you can see the contents of the room. So he would have been informed by the idea of the sun providing us with light. Also, the sun provides us with warmth, the heat of the sun. This idea of what keeps us alive, it keeps us warm. So right here, we already see the idea of wisdom and compassion would have been really, really built into his relationship to the sun, the fact that his family worshiped the sun, and they believed that they were born from the sun, and that the reason they worshiped the sun is they knew that their crops wouldn't grow properly had it not been for the sun, and that they worked the land and that they were able to sustain their lives and actually have some abundance. And really, so there would have been a deep respect for things like the sun, the earth, really the four elements, right? So these ideas would have been floating around in his head probably at a very, very early age. Now, the interesting thing is, most of Dharma theory, maybe all of Dharma theory, is rooted in this idea of a seed and a fruit and cultivation. So a lot of what we try to do is we try to cultivate ourselves, or let's just think about qualities that we cultivate in Dharma practice. Something like obvious, like kindness, right? Kindness is just an idea in the mind. It's just a concept, right? And many of us probably would believe and would probably have no problem saying or admitting that kindness is like a good thing and that being more kind would be a good thing. But believing that or knowing that or thinking that isn't necessarily going to make you any more kind. See what I mean? So this is where I think that Buddhism as a belief system is very, very problematic, because what you believe is, frankly, for the Buddha, very irrelevant. It's what you can do, how you live, what you're able to do with those beliefs or those ideas. And so this word wisdom, I think, which is an interesting word, when people think of Buddhism, we think of the Buddha, we think of wisdom, right? We think, oh, the Buddha's wise, all-knowing, whatever, whatever. But I, as a teacher over the years, it used to kind of bother me, because if you asked me what wisdom was, I wouldn't really be able to give you much of an answer. You know, what the hell is wisdom? And if I was wise, what would I actually know? Interesting question. I used to steer away from the term because of these very ideas. I mean, we have a sense of what wisdom is, but mostly we associate it with knowledge. People who are wise, who have knowledge. And if you look at the way that the term wisdom is described by the Buddha in the early tradition, is this term panya, which is, so he's saying that wisdom actually happens in stages. So wisdom, and he says this time and time again in the canon, wisdom needs to be cultivated. You have to cultivate wisdom. You don't just have it. And so a lot of times people will ask him, they'll say, well, they'll go to the Buddha. Oftentimes in the canon, the story goes, somebody will come up to the Buddha, they'll sort of bow three times, and they'll ask him some question, which is half of the canon is some random person asking him a question about one of his teachings. And a few times people ask him, what's the difference between consciousness and wisdom? Or what's the difference between the mind and wisdom? And he would always say that the mind or consciousness needs to be understood or fully known, and wisdom needs to be cultivated. So how do you cultivate wisdom? And are you willing to do the work that is required to cultivate wisdom? Most of us in our English-speaking minds, we just think of wisdom as knowledge or information, which, as we probably can all discern, is not always all that helpful. You know, having knowledge is not necessarily going to contribute to your life in a meaningful way. Sometimes it can contribute to your life in a detrimental way. You end up having all the fucking right answers to all the wrong questions. So when he thinks about what wisdom is, he says it happens in stages. So the first stage is the concept. So there's a theory, there's an application, and then there's what's called fruition, which is a three-stage process. So the idea would be like, well, kindness is a good thing, and I understand kindness conceptually, and I think it's important, but I can't just stop there. Something like mindfulness too, right? Mindfulness is a good thing, and we want to have mindfulness, and yada, yada, yada. But if you don't cultivate it, if you don't practice it, it's just a fucking idea in your head. It's just another thing that you believe. It's just another thing that you're right about, which probably won't have a lot of value. So we have the idea, we apply it, we actually do it, and then fruition is the outcome. And so fruition, which is tied to the word fruit, obviously, is this kind of, you know it works, and you know it's valuable, and you know it's true, and you have wisdom because you've understood it conceptually, you've actually tried it out, and you've actually seen some results, which is really what the Buddha's trying to get us to do time and time again. As he says, all the teachings are what's called ahipasako, come and see for yourself. The Buddha always says, don't take my word for it, come and see. If these things are helpful to you and they contribute to your life in a meaningful way, then you should cultivate them. And if they don't contribute to your life in a meaningful way, then you should abandon them. Right? So we really are our first person. You are your own laboratory. In fact, when Siddhartha Gautama, who was a person, really what he's trying to say is that you're all Buddha. We are all all have this kind of potential to understand our minds, to apply different practices, different ethics, different philosophies to our mind and our lived experience. And we can see that there's benefit from doing certain things, and we can see that there's deficits, or there's certain things that we do that aren't helpful to us, right? And this becomes a long, slow, grinding kind of, you know, task of trial and error, which is great, I think, because then it always leaves me in the driver's seat, which is I would prefer to drive, rather than just trust or believe something. So again, really, it's not really about belief at all. It's really more about, maybe more about behavior, or more about how we live or how we cultivate our experience. So all of his teachings, everything is kind of, you back it way, way back up into where it comes from. It would really come from these kinds of ideas. And I think that these are important, because when we talk about, you know, meditation, which, it's sort of annoying to me, because I'm known as a Buddhist teacher, and I really don't like Buddhism, and I'm known as a meditation teacher, and I don't really like the word meditation. So I kind of irritate myself with these things, but meditation is, of course, a grossly misunderstood term. But if we think about it as a cultivation, then we start to realize, oh, there's actually lots of things that I want to cultivate in a Dharma capacity. You know, I want to cultivate ethics or integrity. I want to live a life that's more in line with my sense of values and my sense of integrity, the things that I think are important to embody. And that doesn't mean, you know, you yank down the Buddhist list of, well, what does the Buddhist believe about how one should behave in the world? That can be helpful to some degree, and there's nothing wrong with that. But ultimately, we have to decide for ourselves what our, for lack of a better word, and maybe it's a good word, our own moral compass. And can we live a life that's somewhat in agreement or congruent with our own moral compass, which I'm sure you've noticed is actually not that easy to do. You know, I believe that kindness is an important thing. Am I kind all the time? No, I'm actually not kind all the time. I've cultivated more kindness than I had, you know, 20 years ago. I didn't practice kindness at the level I do now, but I'm still not done. You know, things like kindness and generosity and nonviolence. There's a whole bunch, of course, of kind of Buddhist qualities that we might cultivate. So to limit the practice in terms of meditation, we kind of just end up with, well, we cultivate mindfulness, or we cultivate the mind and we become more wise. But really, when we do that, when we just make it about the mind, we miss out on a lot of these other things that are really built into the entire structure. You know, the sense of integrity that we have, which is important, because when we, I'm sure you've noticed, I know that I've noticed, when I do things in my life that are not in line with my sense of values, I feel bad about it. I feel regret. Maybe I feel guilty, or I feel ashamed, or I feel I should be better at being a good person by now, right? I don't suspect I'm ever going to stop doing that. I feel like that's an ongoing practice. So when we think about our practice, one way to think about it that I think is helpful is that when we do like a seated practice, which of course we'll do here in a bit, meditation, there's that word again, I get stuck using it. When we sit on a cushion and we spend 20 minutes a day being in our breath and our experience, that's not practice really, that's training. So we do have to spend some time every day. We go on retreats. We spend 20 minutes a day, 30 minutes a day, a couple days a week, whatever we can seem to come up with. It's hard in the modern world, man, to fucking develop a good practice. But that's, we're training. You know, we're training our minds. We're, you know, it's the fucking treadmill. It's going to the gym. It's a behavior. But everything else that you do after that is your practice. You know, how you think, how you view the world, how you view yourself, the intentions that prompt your actions, the choices that you make, the work that you do, the jobs that you have, the survival that you do, all of that stuff is very much practice. And that's a lot of cultivation. And the reason I say that is one of the things I try to instill in people's minds, I think that's valuable, is people in our culture get caught up into this setup pretty quickly, and you might actually be there now. But what happens is we get caught up in the setup where we have like a meditation practice, and then we have the rest of our life. And we somehow think or believe that those are somewhat separate. You know what I mean? Like, I have a practice and then I have the rest of my life. And then we end up missing out on all these other opportunities in the rest of our life to practice because we just think it's about this 20 minutes I do a day. And then to some degree we believe, and this is no fault of our own, this is kind of the way the society talks about it, but I think it's a bad move, is that the general theory is, well, the more that I meditate, the better my life will become, or the easier my life will become. Or, and maybe that's true, and probably that's true to some degree, but that's missing a lot. You're missing out on a big slice of the pie if you're kind of just doing that. So when we think about these trainings, training the mind in a seated practice is very valuable. But we have to see that there's some congruency between how I live my life and what happens when I sit down and watch my mind. Because one thing you'll start to notice quickly, if you haven't already, is that when I sit down and close my eyes, you know what shows up? My life. You know, as soon as I sit down, the first thing my mind goes to is like, whatever I think I did recently that I fucked up. My mind goes, yeah, man, well, you really fucking dropped the ball yesterday on that thing. Or it just kind of goes right there. It starts to remind me about, you know, it has its little list of like, here's the five things you're not doing right in your life right now. Right? So we see the rest of our life shows up in our practice. So, like, if we have times in our life where we're overworked, we're stressed out, we have financial obligations, family obligations, the more stress that we have in our life, that stress actually usually shows up in our practice. And then what a lot of people say, they go, oh, my practice is really shit. Or, you know, my mind's really active during my practice or whatever. And I usually go, well, what's going on in your life? And usually what happens is people talk about, they're stressed out about this, they're stressed out about that, this isn't going well, that's not going well. I'm like, well, of course your practice is hard right now. They're so correlated with each other, right? They're so correlated with each other. So we're trying to train our minds when we practice so that way we're not even really training for that moment. You know, like people in the Olympics, right? They spend years and years and years and years and years and years training. And then maybe if they're lucky, they do like one event. You know, but when we sit and do training, when we sit and do a kind of formal practice, we're not trying to necessarily be in the moment then, or we're not trying to have a pleasant, quiet mind then. We're just trying to prepare ourselves for the shit show that's going to fucking happen the moment we get up. You know, the texts and the emails and the bills and the this and the that and the boss and the culture and the COVID and these people. And the fucking world just comes racing right back. So we have to prepare ourselves for that because we react to that stuff so much of the time. And so we get into this, you know, we think that present time awareness is supposed to be pleasant time awareness. How many, and this, I still do this, and I think it's funny because I've said it a million times, you think I'd caught on by now, but how many times have you sat for 20 minutes or 30 minutes and your mind was kind of quiet and the body didn't hurt and it was kind of a pleasant experience, and at the end of it you said to yourself, oh, that was a good one. Oh yeah, I'm really getting it now. I'm really, really getting somewhere now. And then the next day, 2 days later, 3 days later, your mind's all over the place. You're distracted. You sit for 30 minutes and maybe you're with like three breaths at the best. And at the end of it, you think to yourself, well, that one was shit. And you're like, I guess I'm not as good as this as I thought I was. So our measuring stick is really pretty bad. In fact, the idea of even having a measuring stick for practice is kind of a little bit of a fool's errand. Because, you know, our measuring stick is basically, you know, how good it feels or how calm we were, which is just like, sometimes you just get lucky. You know, sometimes I think it's that simple. Sometimes you just sit for 30 minutes and by all appearances, you're in the present moment and things kind of go well and there's not a lot of distractions. And sometimes I think we just get fucking lucky, you know. But then well, of course, I got to pat myself on the back. Oh, yeah, that was a good one. I'm really getting this now. Right. So for practice this evening, I wanted to start actually with a practice that I was trained to teach that I don't think you'll find a lot of people do. So when we think about trainings, there's really three trainings that the Buddha talks about in the Eightfold Path. Is we train and we develop the mind and the heart through contemplative practices, through meditation, through mindfulness, through metta. That's part of it. We want to, because he says we want to understand our minds. We want to fully know. We want to fully understand consciousness and how it performs. And the only way to do that is to sit and watch it. and watch all the shitty behavior that your mind just came with, right? And then we train in ethics. We train in trying to live by our own values and moral compass, so however you want to think about that. Integrity for me is the word that makes the most sense. Do we live in line with our sense of integrity? And then we train in wisdom. And so how do you do that, right? Well, how do you train in wisdom? Well, really, wisdom is just the result of developing the mind and living ethically. That's, you know, so that even the idea that you're training in wisdom is even a little bit kind of not accurate to say. Wisdom is the outcome of those two. And then the real outcome is that when you see that something works, you'll do it again. You're like, oh, I was in that exchange with that person who I think is an asshole, and I was a lot more friendly to him that time, and the exchange went better. Maybe next time I encounter this person, I should try to be more friendly. And that's wisdom. It's showing you there's other options that you have in the way that you behave, in the way that you work, in the way that you confront the world. And what you really want to have is a nice, elaborate drop-down menu of options as much of the time as possible. But a lot of us, if we're honest, our drop-down menus maybe got two or three bad ideas in it, and that's about it, right? So when we do the sila practice, it's really a couple ways to think about it. Is recognizing your sense of goodness, recognizing your own desire to, you know, want to be a positive change in this world, your desire to, you know, you wouldn't spend the money and spend evening times coming to these classes if you didn't have some sense that this shit was going to be helpful. So it's also an optimistic thing, and it's a recognition that, you know what, I can do better. And it's a really kind of rich practice. Sila, a hard word to translate. I think it mostly means something like integrity, goodness, nonviolence, kindness, generosity. All these things are sila practices, and they don't get taught in our meditation culture very much as a kind of contemplative practice. But it very much can be, and I was taught and trained to teach it as a guided practice. So you may not have done this before. We'll do it for maybe about 30 minutes or so. And I think you might find that it's actually